Our in-depth guest today is Eva Hagberg Fisher, author of the new book, How to Be Loved, a memoir of life-saving friendship from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Eva's writing has appeared in the New York Times, Tin House, Wallpaper, Wired, and Jwell, and she holds degrees in architecture from UC Berkeley and Princeton, as well as a doctorate in visual and narrative culture from UC Berkeley. In the words of writer Jennifer Pasteloff, Eva Hagberg Fisher is a gift to this world. Her astute understanding of the way we work as humans and the way she can turn that understanding into compassion, love, and stories is something to behold. Her writing is necessary and heart-mending. Eva will be at Powell City of Books tonight at 7:30 in conversation with Sophia Shalmayeff. Eva, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thank you so much.
Now, Eva, we first mentioned in the intro your degrees in architecture. Memoir writing's a little bit unrelated. And you still do consulting in the architecture field.
I do, and I still write about architecture. So I
wondered if you use some of that background in the planning and structuring of How to Be Loved.
Yeah, so you're wildly original, but you're not the first person to have pointed out that I have these two seemingly unrelated careers. But I graduated from college with this degree in architecture and wanted to write. And I had this sort of meteoric ascent as an architecture writer. And the process of learning how to write to deadline was extraordinarily useful when it came to writing a book. I had 15 years of practice of kind of getting over myself and not worrying so much and just realizing, you know, if I don't file this copy, the magazine goes to print with a hole in its pages. I can't do that. So I need to put aside whatever anxiety or stress or whatever, and I just need to write. I don't have a fear of the blank page. I don't have a fear of needing to edit drafts, you know, in the case of this book, 47 times. And so when I sold the book, I had a really pragmatic approach to it, which was that I had signed a contract, I'd cashed a check, I better deliver. And that professionalizing of what can I think often feel like it might be a scarily intimate or personal or emotional process really helped me to have this level of sort of dispassionate investment, but also not hyper close emotionality when I wrote. So
it was kind of all this, these emotions are coming out as you're remembering them, but you're doing it in a very professional way. You're saying because you picked that up as a writer.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have emotions while I was writing. I mean, I just had concern that I accurately represent the emotions that I had had at the time. Or I would think, okay, I want the reader to believe on page 45, it's not a specific page, but right, believe that people have called me a sociopath. Okay, how do I provide evidence for that so that by the time the reader reads that, they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense given what I've read about this character. So a lot of it really felt pragmatic. I described myself as just an accountant who goes to work, but instead of dealing with numbers and columns, I deal with sentences and dialogue, and the questions felt really technical. And only now do I have any sort of emotional relationship to it. And I just think, like, how did I do that? How did I survive all those things? Like, that was terrible.
And I could tell listeners that the reader will not have the same experience. There's a lot of emotions that will come up as a reader, and I'm sure of it. They did with me. In a blurb on your website, writer Adam Nemeth writes, I highly recommend this book to anyone who's ever been reassured that everything will be fine when they really want others to honor that terror that maybe it won't. It's extremely hard to do for most of us, myself included. We feel the need to stay positive. What were the typical responses from friends and family when you were going through your medical problems? And there were a few, doctor visits and brain surgery.
So the responses really varied. And one of the things that I learned to do was ask outright for the response that I wanted. But I had people who got into at least wars with me, where I would say, I just got this terrible news, my tumor marker rose, and they'd say, at least your legs still work. And I'd say, well, I'm really tired. They don't actually work that well. And they'd say, well, at least your hands work. You're typing, you're typing on your phone. And I'd say, well, I feel really, So I finally realized, okay, that's not somebody that I should go to. So I got this sort of like, at least look on the bright side. I got a lot of what's next, what's next, what's next? What does this mean? How should we feel? Is this good or is this bad? And I could feel this desire for certainty that people had. And I rebelled against that at first very gracelessly, and hopefully with a little bit more grace later on. And that was a really huge one. You know, the wanting to sort of locate oneself in relationship to a tragedy and know how to respond. And I have a section in the book where, you know, I get this news right after brain surgery that I don't have cancer where they thought I did, but I probably have it where they also thought I did. And people around me were exhibiting relief because they'd been expecting a diagnosis that day. And I talk about wanting to know, like, am I relieved? Am I not relieved? Am I more scared because now I just have to wait? Like, I don't know, but I could feel people were like, what a relief, what a relief, what a relief.
And there was quite a bit, a long period of uncertainty after the surgery before you got, I won't give it away, but different news.
Exactly.
Or results. Now, your friend Allison, who you mentioned in the very first sentence of the book, had her own medical problems. She's a terminal cancer patient. She passed away a few years ago. And she was the first one to honor your terror that maybe everything won't be fine. Can you tell us a little bit about Allison and her response? And of course, most of the book is about that relationship.
Yeah. I mean, I love that she wanted to be in the whole book because originally she was just going to have a couple chapters, but she asserted herself on the page. She would say things to me like, oh, this sounds so hard. And of course you're scared. And I remember when I was preparing for brain surgery, I sent out this email to all my friends and I talked to her and I said, oh God, you know, do you think I was just looking for attention? And she said, yeah, because you need attention right now. And she was the first person that I think had enough comfort with her own, I don't want to say comfort with her suffering, but enough familiarity with a life that is really full of suffering, that she wasn't afraid of mine. And then when I saw how she acted when she wasn't afraid of my suffering, I was able to start looking for that in other people and really try to cultivate that and really be with people who could say, you know, this just sounds really awful and I'm so sorry that you're going through it. But she also, you know, I remember one very sort of histrionic day where I'm like imagining my funeral and I'm like, what do you think people are going to say? And she's like, listen, buddy, like I'm actually dying. We don't know what's going on with you, but nobody has so far said that you're actually on the brink of death. So like, why don't you cool it on your funeral fantasies? And that's what I needed to hear. But she also was able to understand that I was just grasping. You know, I was so confused and demoralized. And she was able to compassionately bring me back.
And there was quite a bit of wisdom and compassion in her. And part of that probably came from her own terminal cancer diagnosis. But there must have been quite a bit of that already in her, I would think.
Yeah, I only knew her sick, but I think that also it's sort of also the product of just a lifetime of personal growth for her and constant sort of togetherness with people. And I think that that had a lot to do with it. But also, yeah, I mean, illness and her husband's illness, I think, taught her a lot.
Now, in a print interview you did with The Rumpus, you make a point that you didn't want to write a primarily illness-focused memoir. What were your reasons for that, for avoiding that, if I can call it a genre? And what would you say is the primary focus of the book?
So there are some amazing illness memoirs, and I sort of felt like they all say what I would have said. So Two Types of Decay by Sarah Manguso, it describes suffering in a way that is so profound that I don't need to do that work. Barbara Ehrenreich's Brightsided, there's a lot of existing literature that does what I think an illness memoir could have done. And I also really didn't want readers to be sort of turned off by thinking that they were going to read a litany of events that happened at the doctor. I think that we do have a sort of cultural exhaustion with that sort of medical trauma porn, you know, for lack of a better term. And so my focus with the book was really about friendship and the way in which illness was a sort of deus ex machina plot twist in my life that cleared away a lot of the stuff I was trying to work out in therapy, like my fear of intimacy, my perfectionism, I mean, all of which still exist. But it was this great wind that blew in. And then in the absence and in the space that illness created, my friends really showed me how to be loved. You know, my friends like Allison and Lauren and Layla. And I realized later my friends that have always been there. But I feel like the subtitle of the book is against bravery or against teleology. I mean, I'm really against this idea that sick people are in our culture to sort of teach us wise things. And I use this line of like the tourism of illness. And I really wanted to sort of bring that to light and then also question that and also explore the ways in which sometimes I wanted to be the really wise sage. You know, I wanted to be the person who was like, yes, I've been to the abyss. Like, let me tell you about it. But also I just wanted to be a regular 32-year-old, like, talking shit about boyfriends and, you know, going to J. Crew and doing whatever and just showing the sort of multifaceted lives of people who struggle with, you know, in my case, extraordinarily life-threatening illness.
Now, earlier today on KBOO, by coincidence, we aired an interview with Sarah McCall, and she also just published her first book. It's a memoir entitled Joy Enough. She mentioned in the interview, it was a conversation between her and local writer, Portland writer Margaret Malone, the issue of allowability, what you can include and maybe what you shouldn't include in a memoir. Was that a challenge for you? As that blurb we read earlier said, it's an unflinching look at your situation.
Yeah, I mean, I felt very, very, very concerned about how other people were going to feel. And then I had to put that concern aside in order to write the book that I needed to write. But I always thought anytime I introduce another character, right, I talk about my family, I talk about my mom, I talk about my dad, I didn't give them drafts for approval. I just wrote it. But I kept thinking to myself, this is not about their transformations. And so if I have a scene with somebody else, am I responsible for myself and my own actions and my own behavior? And I talked to my friend Adam Nemet, who'd done that blurb, and I asked him, like, you know, is this a burn book? Like, do you think that I mean to anybody? And he said, no, I think you're just really ruthless with yourself, but not with anybody else. But there were also, yeah, I mean, there were definitely things that I think I would have written differently if I existed in a complete vacuum, but thankfully I don't.
Now, you mentioned that ruthlessness, or Adam did, the ruthlessness to yourself. Allowability, of course, extends not just to what other people might want to see in the book, but also what you might not want to reveal about yourself. You write that you had a strong aversion to being vulnerable. How did you come to terms with that?
So there's this great phrase that I've heard from people that you can't save your ass and your face at the same time. And I really felt that, you know, so I want to save face constantly, right? I want to have perfect behavior all the time. I want to be consistent. But what I found is that I had this complication after brain surgery where my pituitary was injured and my body couldn't actually absorb its own water. And so my heart rate would start rising, and at a certain point, I'd have to go to the emergency room. And I didn't know how to drive, and Lyft didn't exist yet. So the only way for me to get the life-saving care that I needed was to ask somebody for help and to, you know, sit there and measure my heart rate, measure my pulse, and then be like, yep, it's like 140. I need to go to the ER. And there were so many times that I felt so ashamed that I needed to go back and that I wasn't over this and that I wasn't stronger. And I would try to meditate my heart rate down. But like, if you're profoundly dehydrated, you can't do that. And so that black and white physical practice and the way in which my friends were unendingly compassionate let me see, okay, my friends are going to be here when I'm really physically vulnerable. I wonder if they can be here when I'm emotionally vulnerable. And I would sort of titrate in my tolerance for saying, you know, I'm really scared and I don't know what to do. And I was met with love and compassion. And then that let me titrate in a little bit more and a little bit more. And then eventually now, you know, I just am sort of wired from positive experience to live my life out loud, to live my life in public, to go through things publicly. And I keep, you know, I have this fantasy that one day I'll be this like stoic, mysterious person who will allude vaguely to some personal challenges. But like, I open my mouth and I'm like, here's my latest MRI. Here's my stage 4 endometriosis situation. Here's what's going on in my relationship. Here's the thing I'm most ashamed of. Like, that's just what I do. And that's just my job in this lifetime.
Now, Eva, we mentioned you'll be reading at Powell's tonight. That's the downtown Powell's on Burnside, West Burnside.
Yes.
We talked about directions a little earlier. And that's at 7:30. How can listeners find out more about your upcoming events and How to Be Loved?
So they can go to my website, evahagbergfisher.com. They can follow me on Instagram, where I'm at Eva Hagberg Fisher. And they can also follow me on Twitter, where I'm at Eva Hagberg. But I should say, my Twitter is mostly architecture hot takes.
So, so if they're interested in that, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's great content, place. But it's not about this.
Well, good luck tonight, and thanks very much for coming into KABU, Eva.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking with Eva Hagberg-Fisher, author of the new book, How to Be Loved, a memoir of life-saving friendship from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Eva will be at Powell's City of Books tonight at 7:30 in conversation with Sophia Shalmayeff. This is Ken Jones for KABU's News in Depth.